Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present David Pepper, former chair of Ohio's Democratic Party and author, who recommends 8 ways to respond to Donald Trump's election victory and his threat to democracy over the next 4 years. Author and columnist Wajahat Ali, who looks into why Trump voters aren't asked to try and understand the millions of Americans who oppose their convicted felon president who incited an insurrection. And Sheldon Pollack, a climate activist with Third Act, who talks about the mounting pressure on New York Governor Kathy Hochul to sign the Climate Change Superfund bill that would make fossil fuel companies pay for their pollution. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 7 years of confinement in Cox's Bazar refugee camp in Bangladesh, Muslim Rohingya refugees are returning to Western Myanmar as armed fighters. They're being funded and armed by the Myanmar army, who drove out nearly 1 million Rohingya in 2017. The Rohingya lack any citizenship status in Myanmar, but are now being lured back by the promise of regaining rights long denied by Myanmar's military government. The United Nations called the expulsion of the Rohingya from Myanmar by the pro-Buddhist majority a genocide. In recent months, Myanmar's army has lost ground to the ethnic Arakan army in Rakhine State. Reuters reports that the army has responded to their losses by offering money and citizenship documents to several thousand Rohingya fighters who are being recruited to battle the Arakan army. The emergence of trained Rohingya fighters and weapons in the Cox's Bazar refugee camp with over 1 million residents is viewed as a ticking time bomb by Bangladeshi officials. Some 30,000 children are born into deep poverty in the camps every year, where violence is rampant. Over 40,000 people marched to New Zealand's parliament in mid-November to protest legislation that seeks to reinterpret the country's 184-year-old founding treaty of Waitangi, which was signed between British colonizers and the indigenous Maori people. The controversial Treaty Principles Bill, introduced by Parliament member David Seymour of the Libertarian ACT Party, a junior member of the governing coalition, charges that the Treaty of Waitangi has led to the formation of a dual system for New Zealanders, where the Maori people have been given special treatment. Al Jazeera reports that the bill is strongly opposed by New Zealand's political parties on both the left and the right. The Maori people believe that the ACT Party is hiding its racism behind the claim that all New Zealanders should have equal rights. The divisive legislation is widely expected to be defeated. Billionaire investors John Paulson and Bill Ackman are making huge financial bets the giant mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will be privatized during the second Trump administration. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac underwrite and repackage most of the nation's 30-year home mortgages. The two giant mortgage companies were placed under government conservatorship after the 2008 housing and economic crisis. Any move to privatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could create instability in the nation's mortgage market. Home mortgage rates increased after Trump's election victory as investors anticipated privatization. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stock prices have also risen 120% since the November 5th election. Although the first Trump administration's attempt to privatize Fannie and Freddie stalled in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic, it's now expected that the White House will push for privatization by 2027. Some mortgage industry observers fear an abrupt change to the market will drive mortgage rates up. Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics, who also advised the Kamala Harris campaign, said that whatever scenario you pick, it's just worse than the status quo. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As the nation absorbs the new post-election reality, we're getting a stark reminder of the chaos and incompetence witnessed during Trump's first 4 years in the White House, with the convicted felons announced list of new cabinet nominees. A frightening preview of the disastrous next 4 years can clearly be seen in the parade of Trump's nominee misfits that includes unqualified sycophant Fox News host Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense, anti-vaxxer RFK Jr. to lead Health and Human Services, both accused of sexual abuse, and extremist conspiracy theorist Kash Patel for director of the FBI. With half the country alarmed about the damage Trump and his regime may cause over the next 4 years, many are now looking for advice on effective ways to oppose Trump's campaign pledge of revenge and retribution targeting his perceived enemies that includes Democrats, Never Trump Republicans, the free press, and leftist dissidents. When David Pepper, former chair of Ohio's Democratic Party, received a letter expressing despair and fear of Trump's commitment to form a repressive authoritarian government, he replied with a hopeful piece he called Resolve, Eight Reasons That Keep Me Going, suggesting constructive methods to wage effective resistance over the next 4 years, which he summarizes here.
My goal in life is not to share sort of naively optimistic, unrealistic hope. I don't think that serves us well. I mean, I wrote a book, as you described, called 2025, which is here's what will happen if Trump wins. So I'm not afraid to look reality in the eye when it's bleak. And I don't just I don't feel it's my job to spread false hope. But I also was alarmed by her. This is someone I know well. This is a real professional expert on democracy. So to get this email from her was quite, you know, alarming is too strong a word, but really kind of to me caught my attention about where people are if she was there. And so I tried to share, you know, what I think is true, which is, you know, yes, it's very sobering. It's very disturbing. At the same time, as I won't go through all of them, but, you know, this country has been in worse places. People in worse places than we are now overcame it. You know, situations more bleak, people with far fewer rights than we currently have, without the ability to even vote, with neither party wanting them to be able to vote, on and on and on. And so I do think history tells us we can do this. I think that it's important, as I say, that we do it quickly. I'm very worried about younger generations, that they only have seen the worst of politics. And their memory right now is going to be slowly become the majority memory of this country about politics. And so those of us who are a little older who remember it or think of it as better, we've got work to do now to make sure that this country's memory of democracy is not erased. And one of the ways that the worst of American, sort of the darkest moments have set in for decades or longer is because at a certain point, if the only people around never remember better days, they accept it as okay and normal, something that a generation before would have been horrified by. So there's a real responsibility on our shoulders for future generations to not let the memory disappear of, let's say, the post-Voting Rights Act America. That was actually, you know, very, it's always a back and forth, but it was a very high achievement when it came to finally getting close to a broadly inclusive democracy. Right now, there are people who need our help, and that should keep us going. But just to close on a couple, though, I do think, now everything's unpredictable. Everything's unpredictable, but there are certain cycles that do happen. And my hope is, and this doesn't just happen, we have to make it happen. My hope is that this becomes the second term in the way that Bush's second term became an opportunity in 2006 and 2008. in a way, COVID and Biden interrupted what the Donald Trump right-wing agenda actually does for everyday people. Well, that is about to become very clear. Their mandate is very narrow. There really isn't a mandate, but they're claiming a huge one. And from Cash Patel to all these other nominees, RFK, they are way, way overreaching from a very thin mandate that we explained earlier comes a lot simply because Biden was an unpopular incumbent. In them showing their fangs about what their agenda and their sort of oligarchy-based agenda actually is, I think they give Democrats an opportunity to push back very hard and say this is what, you know, when we start to see the higher prices and the economic disruption of the crazy trade policies and the erratic, you know, daily pronouncements and the corruption and the mass deportation, you know, they're going to have a chance to put their policies in place. I think their policies are going to hurt most Americans, including many who voted for them. And we need to go on offense about that. And the timing of 26 actually is the right timing to take advantage of their bad policies, just like we did in 06 and 08 where we swept. I think the alignment of their bad policies with the midterm of what is essentially Trump's second term gives us an opportunity. So my attitude is, and I'm going to write more on this in the coming days, people should be gearing up to get people on the ballot all over this country in way more than just the narrow areas we've been campaigning. Because if Trump does what he's saying, I think it will hurt people. I think it will offend people. I think it will scare people. And I think that could lead to a turnout that's in our favor in 26. And all of a sudden, we have opportunities to win up and down the ballot. So those are some of the things I try to communicate. Again, not trying to be blasé or naive about it. I think we have to make this happen. This is not sort of naive optimism, but I do think it's realistic that there could be opportunities amid this sort of dark moment.
That was David Pepper, former chair of Ohio's Democratic Party and author of Saving Democracy, a user's manual for every American. Find a link to his letter, Resolve, 8 Reasons That Keep Me Going, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There are countless explanations and analyses as to why Donald Trump, a twice-impeached convicted felon found liable for sexual assault and who incited the violent January 6 insurrection, narrowly won the White House again. Many political observers believe the election outcome had more to do with voters' anger at post-pandemic high inflation that's defeated most incumbent politicians around the world than any broad-based embrace of Trump's racist, hateful, and pro-authoritarian rhetoric. But it's worth remembering that after Trump's first Electoral College election victory in 2016, an army of corporate media reporters descended on Midwestern diners to talk with Trump voters to better understand why they'd supported the real estate developer and reality TV star. Most of what was reported focused on some vague notion of economic grievance, mostly ignoring the obvious white backlash to the Obama presidency and attraction to Trump's angry attack on immigrants and communities of color. Wajahat Ali is one writer who did his best to understand the motivation of Trump voters in 2016, but is now fed up with the idea that half or more of America must once again reach out to empathize with Trump supporters. He believes that most of those who voted for Trump this time around clearly understood and accepted the toxic message of their Hitler-quoting white supremacist, misogynist candidate. Your reporter spoke with Ali, author of the book Go Back to Where You Came From, and creator of the Left Hook Substack page, who discusses his recent column titled, When Will Trump Voters Be Asked to Reach Out and Understand the Rest of Us?
Yeah, you know, sometimes you write something and you realize you're not the only one. It touches a nerve, and I'm glad that one did. For the last 9 years, ever since Trump won, remember, he won, folks, in 2016, we have been told by nearly every magazine, every corporate newspaper, every cable news show to reach out and understand the economic anxiety of the Trump voter, to go to the Rust Belt and talk to Chet. But in 9 years, even in 2016 when he won and in 2024 when he won, nobody, not a single institution, not a single newspaper, has asked Trump voters to go understand the grievances of the urban diner. The rest of us, you know, the 48% who voted for Kamala Harris, or the 81 million who came out during a pandemic for Joe Biden, or the fact that the popular vote went to Clinton, they have never reached out to us to understand us, right? To heal the divides. It's always a one-way relationships, completely not reciprocal. And I've been married for 12 years. I know something about reciprocity in relationships. It requires good faith efforts on both sides. This is like a type of Stockholm syndrome where we are forced to love the violent force that hijacks us, right? That demands civility but gives cruelty, that wants only safe spaces for themselves but only gives us meanness and uncivility and ridicule and misogyny. And somehow we're supposed to perpetually take care of their grievances, but they never care about our grievances. In fact, they relish in our misery, right? It's all about owning the libs. So I said, I'm not one to engage in an unfair relationship where there's no reciprocity. When there's no reciprocity, that means that's abuse. And I, for one, am not a masochist. I don't know about you, Scott. So I have no business or no concern or no care anymore to reach out and understand the side that has voted for a criminal vulgarian who has not changed his stripes in 9 years. He's revealed more of himself and of his voters. 2016, I was a little bit more sympathetic. Maybe people didn't know. They wanted a change in the establishment. 2020, I'm like, you got 4 years of chaos. What more do you want? This guy lied to you during a pandemic, literally told us to inject bleach, was a complete cluster F. You still voted for him. And now that he's a criminal and has incited an insurrection, you're telling me that you would rather vote for a criminal who quotes Hitler than a competent black Indian woman. I'm done. I don't need to understand you. I don't need to reach out to you. I don't need for you to solve your grievances, your perpetual rage. I'm going to take care of myself, my family, my communities, and the majority of Americans who had the good sense either not to vote for him or who voted for Kamala Harris. And I think that is what we should concentrate on, about 65% of America. I believe, Scott, that thanks to the disinformation network, I said this before on your show, I think we have lost about 35% of Americans for the rest of my lifetime. I don't know about you, but I'm done reaching out, especially when there's no reciprocity. Let them reach out. That's the gist of it.
In your media work, you cover disinformation, now widespread on social media and in the bro podcast sphere. Legacy media is dying and local journalism and newspapers are dead in a growing number of cities and towns. And the concern here is that we need a strategy to break through the disinformation bubble that is influencing a critical number of voters. And my concern, of course, is that even this dying legacy media is going to normalize Trump's next 4 years in office. I'm not sure you can offer anything to give me hope, Wajahat, but do your best.
You know, they're going to bend the knee. And so what people have to realize, as you mentioned before, is that people are leaving legacy media, corporate media, because people are tired of the lies. They're tired of an establishment that refuses to reform. They're tired of people bending the knee and kissing Trump's butt. They want the truth. And they want people with a little bit of fire in their belly. And I think the people who give them the truth and show the fire, like you and others, I think they will be rewarded. I refuse to reach out to the Trump voter. I go into these right-wing spaces to debate. I only do it to disrupt, but you can't win them over, right? Instead, I say build out your own. Build out your own community, take care of yourself, inform yourself. Remind people that this man has never cracked 50. He's a highly divisive person leading a very divided country, right? Build out the liberal progressive media ecosystem. There's a lot of us, folks. We're going to have to build it out from the grassroots. The Avengers aren't coming. And also, I want to remind you that a lot of people switched from Trump to Biden back to Trump, right? There are these voters who just want something different. So if you give them something different, if you give them a better message, if you give them a better story, and if we do have free and fair elections, we can win over enough people. And finally, I'll say, you know, Michelle Obama, God bless her, when she said, when they go low, we go high, I have always rejected that. I say, when they go low, you put them in a knee bar and you take them out, which is a valid legal UFC move. Forget the civility police. We need fighters. We need a new breed of fighters. And the Democratic establishment, anyone who is still willing to play by the civility rules and brings a pencil to a knife fight, you can fire them into the sun. Forget them, reject them, move on. A new generation of fighters has to rise up. Might as well be us in this new generation. Why not? We got to save ourselves.
That was Rajat Ali, author of Go Back to Where You Came From and creator of the Left Hook Substack page. Find a link to his column titled When Will Trump Voters Be Asked to Reach Out and Understand the Rest of Us? And related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last spring, both the New York State Senate and Assembly passed what is known as the Climate Change Superfund Bill, which would hold major fossil fuel company emitters of CO2 accountable to pay to mitigate the cost of their pollution and climate change adaptation. The legislation takes inspiration from the Federal Superfund Law of 1980 and the tobacco settlements of the 1990s that's funneled billions of dollars into state coffers. It's estimated that the Climate Superfund bill would raise $75 billion from oil, coal, and gas companies over 25 years. The bill has been sitting on New York Governor Kathy Hochul's desk for the past 6 months, and she has until the end of this year to sign it, or advocates must start the process over again. This issue is drawing attention, as President-elect Trump has pledged to eliminate most federal programs and funding to address the global climate crisis. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sheldon Pollack, a retired professor at Columbia University and an activist with Third Act, a national group for people over 60 who take action on climate and democracy issues. Here, Pollack explains what the bill would do and describes Third Act's plan for a sit-in and teach-in at the Capitol in Albany, December 10th through the 12th, to encourage the governor to sign the bill.
We see that in the past 50 years, there have been several judicial judgments that polluters must pay for the harms that they cause. And the Climate Change Superfund bill is a recent avatar, if I may, of this kind of thinking. So what does it actually do? The Climate Change Superfund bill requires that the big companies who have polluted the water and air of New York State should pay for the harms that they cause. The harms are principally climate disasters, which are a result of the climate change produced by the product sold, Superstorm Sandy, and all the other lesser but equally damaging examples of climate disasters caused by climate change produced by big oil. The total value of the Climate Change Superfund bill, the penalties, only amounts to $75 billion. That is the most modest possible cost of the harms that Big Oil's product has produced. Because the climate change impacts on New York State over the coming 30 years are going to be orders of magnitude greater than $75 billion. Just to rehab New York Harbor is going to cost $50 billion. To say nothing of costs to towns and villages and cities whose entire tax burden would be encumbered by climate catastrophe costs. Who are the big climate criminals who are being assessed damages? There are the usual suspects, Saudi Aramco, Exxon, Shell, Chevron, and on down the list. Their contributions have been very carefully assessed by the best scientists and scholars around to apportion blame to these companies. And in fact, as I mentioned, $75 billion, when the total profits of these companies vastly exceeds that, is really a slap on the wrist. The second most important part of this bill is the people it protects. If this bill is not signed, then who's going to have to make up the $75 billion in costs? It's going to be the people of New York State, everyday people, small people, who are going to be taxed to death to cover the climate catastrophes that big oil has produced. We can't let that happen.
So now tell me, what are the plans for action next week?
My dear comrade Michael Richardson one of the co-facilitators of Third Act Upstate New York, and I, who am a member of Third Act New York City, we looked at the lay of the land about 6 weeks ago. We saw the clock ticking. We heard rumblings that the bill might be in trouble. We, Michael and I, felt that this was a fundamental violation on the governor's part of the will of the people. The people have spoken through the Senate and the Assembly. They have expressed their will. The use-by date, so to put it, is January 1st of 2025. If the bill is not signed by there, it's dead. And we decided that we needed to have some demonstration of the commitment of the people of New York to this bill and to the democratic process that produced this bill. We decided on the date of December 10th, 11th, and 12th. We had to give the governor enough time to try to sign the bill. She hasn't so far. She called up 50 bills yesterday, and the Superfund bill was not among them. So our judgment was correct. We gave her time. She has not signed the bill. We were walled in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. We knew that there would be some Democratic caucus of the Assembly in Albany around the 10th of December. It's not the most propitious time, but this is the hand we were dealt. What do we do then? How do we express the will of the people in an unambiguous way? Well, we take over the Capitol. The plan is to assemble in Albany at the state capitol at 10 o'clock on the morning of December 10th, and we will start a sit-in. We will start a sit-in that will not end until the governor signs the bill. Now, life being what it is and people's obligations being what they are and so on and so forth, we're not entirely sure how long the sit-in is going to last. At the same time as we have our sit-in, we're going to have a teach-in. We want all of the people in the room to get a good sense of why we're there, the science behind the bill, the politics behind the bill, the place of the bill in the big, long march towards climate safety.
That was Sheldon Pollack, a retired Columbia University professor, an activist with Third Act New York City, and an organizer of the Make Polluters Pay action in Albany, happening December 10th through 12th. Learn more about the legislation and protest action by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter and Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KTAL in Las Cruces, New Mexico, KPRI in Pala, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.